This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Women are told now that if we have a mother or sister who has had breast cancer at a young age, it increases our odds of getting it. What is the genetic link to breast cancer? My guest, Mary Claire King, has spent years looking for genes which cause breast cancer, and she appears to be very close to finding one important one. You may have seen her profiled on the recent PBS series, The Next Generation. This evening on many PBS stations, she will be featured on the series The Secret of Life, a look at how genetic research is transforming science and medicine. She is on the edition Conquering Cancer. King is a professor of genetics and epidemiology at the University of California at Berkeley. She served on the President's Special Commission on Breast Cancer and on the National Cancer Institute's Breast Cancer Task Force. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
When you find this gene, will it help prevent breast cancer? What will it do for those of us who are worried about getting it?
What will we do next? We're looking for this gene for three reasons. One is that we would like to be able to turn this gene over to investigators who can use it to develop a really good, very early diagnostic tool. You know, Terry, mammograms are absolutely critical, and you and I should both be getting them every year. But even the very best mammogram can only pick up a tumor when it's maybe the size of the tip of your little finger, which is very, very small for a tumor, of course. But that tumor has already divided 20 or 30 times, and it may have been in the breast for 6 or 8 years. By the time that tumor has divided 10 more times, it will weigh 2 pounds. We would long since have died of it. If we can back up the time of diagnosis of that tumor to a few cell divisions, before 30 cell divisions have had a chance to happen, we could greatly increase the chance that a woman would survive the whole experience, and of course greatly decrease what it would take to remove the mutant cells, to remove the aberrant cells. We could just go in and pluck them out. There wouldn't be nearly the invasive kind of procedures we have to use now. So for me, one absolutely critical use of this kind of information will be to use it to develop a molecular mammogram, if you like, to combine molecular biology with mammography. Obviously, I'm not going to be capable of doing that, but other people are.
Now, assuming there's a genetic link to breast cancer, are we talking about finding a gene that has become a mutant gene and is therefore causing breast cancer?
Yeah, this is real subtle. And let me try to explain it. You tell me if I'm getting this, if this is clear or not. All of breast cancer is genetic. All of cancer is genetic. Cancer is genes in cells that have gone awry so that cells no longer divide in a controlled way. Occasionally, rarely, those genes are inherited from parent to child in that altered form. Inheriting a gene like that all by itself doesn't cause cancer, obviously, or people in families with many cases of cancer would be born with it, and of course they're not. But it's one critical step. So I guess what I'm saying is that in some families, genes that can go awry in cells of anybody have actually gone awry in all the cells of the body. They're inherited from parent to child, but that has no effect until something else happens as well. So the impact of all that for what we're doing is that we're working with unusual families, families in which there has been an extraordinary amount of breast cancer and often of ovarian cancer as well, in order to identify the genes that have gone awry in those particular families in an inherited form, that is, that are being passed from mothers or fathers to children. And if we can identify those genes that are critical in those families to the development of breast and ovarian cancer, then we can generalize to genes that can go awry specifically in the cells of the breast or the cells of the ovary in the rest of us.
Now thinking ahead, assuming you find this gene and we start to understand its role in breast cancer, if a young woman were tested and found to have this gene, what options might she have a few years down the road? I mean, the thing that immediately comes to mind is that someone might choose to have their breasts removed, as I know just a few women are actually doing now.
Yeah, that's true. We, of course, have already confronted this reality in the families with whom we work. In my group, we're working with perhaps 100 families now, and in those families, women who have inherited susceptibility to breast or ovarian cancer are aware of it. We don't have the gene specifically to be able to test, but in those families, we're able to test markers. We can't do that generally yet. we'll have to wait for people like you and me until we actually have the gene. But in some remarkable families, we can test now. And of course, that information has gone back to the women. They know. So what to do? I've, of course, talked with family members a lot about this. It seems to me that a young woman has really three options to consider. And, of course, a woman may select one option at one time in her life and then change her mind later on as she gets older. What most of the young women with whom we work have decided to do is to find a breast surgeon or a gynecologist or a nurse practitioner working with breast surgeons and gynecologists who will do a careful physical exam of their breasts every 3 months. And for young women whose breasts can be well screened by mammogram, which is some of us but not all of us, to have mammograms at least once a year and often once every 6 months, so that if any very small lesions begin to develop, they can be picked up right away.
So you're not an advocate of getting your breasts removed?
Would I do it? I'm 47. I would not. That doesn't mean that it's not ever appropriate. It could be for some women. But I think that there's something that women really need to hear, and that is that there are no studies yet of women who have had prophylactic mastectomy and then have been followed for a long period of time. If you think about it, dissecting off the breasts of a human being is very, very difficult. Now, Susan Love could talk to you much better than I about this, and so what I know is primarily from her and from other surgeons who actually do these procedures. But you don't remove all of the cells at risk. You do not reduce a woman's risk of breast cancer to zero. What is the remaining risk? It's not nothing. Of course you reduce it, but by how much? We need to know the answers to those kinds of questions. There's another consideration also, and this pertains to only a minority of the high-risk families with whom we work, but unfortunately we don't know which minority yet. That is that there's an increased risk of ovarian cancer as well. And, of course, screening for ovarian cancer is much more difficult. So women in some of the families with whom we've worked, where ovarian and breast cancer have occurred, have considered, rather than breast surgery, the possibility of ovarian surgery because of the generally fatal nature of ovarian cancer. Then, of course, one has to consider if a young woman has ovarian surgery, which is, from the surgical point of view, very straightforward, should she take replacement estrogens? Because to begin menopause in one's 30s reduces the quality of life dramatically, and for some women, just beyond the point that it's worth sustaining life at all. If a woman uses replacement estrogens, and I would, if she uses replacement estrogens, that increases her risk of breast cancer again. There's not a simple answer to this, and a woman who is in this situation needs to be able to identify a clinical group with whom to work who will follow her and be able to keep track of this kind of information and how it pertains to her own particular clinical situation. I'm speaking here entirely as a woman. I'm not a clinical person, but I'm just trying to think through what would worry me
right.
if I were in this position.
Right. My guest is Mary Claire King. She's a geneticist, and she's close to finding one of the genes that causes breast cancer. She'll be featured this evening on a PBS series, and that series is called The Secret of Life. Do you have a sense of what percentage of breast cancer cases are actually caused by the type of gene that you're looking for now?
Yes, we do have some good epidemiologic evidence on that point, and it's less than 10%.
Mm-hmm.
That is, less than 10% of breast cancer patients have inherited susceptibility to breast cancer. The gene that we're looking for may very well be involved in a very large fraction of breast cancers, but purely in terms of its action at the level of the cells of the breast. But in terms of inherited risk, fewer than 10% of patients have inherited risk. So the women who are at high risk because they've inherited an altered gene are really acting as the front line for the rest of us in trying to identify the critical locales for these genes. But if you think about it, Terry, even though this is less than 10%, say 5% of all breast cancer patients who've inherited susceptibility to the disease, that's 5% of a very common disease. So there could be in this country as many as 500,000 women who, in fact, have inherited susceptibility to breast and, in some cases, ovarian cancer. So it's a very large number of women overall because, of course, breast cancer is so devastatingly common.
Now, how close are you to finding the gene? Or a gene?
I wish I knew in terms of time, you know, days, weeks, or months. In terms of physical locale, we know of a very, very, very small region, just a few 100,000 base pairs on a particular human chromosome, it happens to be 17, where this gene lives. And we've identified what we hope are all the genes that are in that region. They, of course, find variation because there's an enormous amount of variation in people. And then as we find variants in these genes that are in the right region, we have to try to determine whether those variants are specific to families with high rates of breast cancer or whether they are found in people generally, and whether they have any functional meaning in terms of what might actually go awry in a breast cell.
So you are within the region of the breast cancer gene or genes.
Right, right. In
getting there and finding that region, did you happen into other discoveries along the way?
It's inevitable because the whole nature of human genetics right now is that virtually every time you do an experiment, you find something new. And what we tend to say to each other is that what are weeds to one person are flowers to another. So as we move through the region, as we simply walk along the human chromosome 17 in the region of interest to us, we find genes that other people have found before, not in people, but in other species, like yeast or Drosophila, the fruit flies, or mice, or snakes, or you name it, there will be some geneticist who has looked for genes of interest to them in other species. And what we've found is the human homologue, that is the human equivalent of one or another of those genes. And every day we find those. So every day we tie ourselves as people to other species with yet another connection. Then sometimes we find genes that no one's found before. So we put that information into the general data bank that geneticists access, and pretty soon somebody else will find that gene's useful for their purpose, even though it has nothing to do with our disease. So you are constantly in human genetics now discovering new evolutionary connections between ourselves and other organisms, discovering new genes that are important to cell growth and division, and adding pieces to the puzzle, even if it's not the critical piece for your puzzle. There are essentially no wasted steps.
My guest is geneticist Mary Claire King, and she has spent years investigating the genetic link to breast cancer, and she thinks she's very close to finding one of the genes which causes hereditary breast cancer. You can see her this evening on many PBS stations on the series The Secret of Life, which looks at how genetic research is transforming science and medicine. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is geneticist Mary Claire King. You were the scientist, I believe, who discovered that the genome of the chimp and the human are about 99% the same.
When I was a graduate student in Alan Wilson's lab at Berkeley, he and therefore all of us were very interested in how similar we are to chimpanzees. Mm-hmm. And this was back in the days when we did those kinds of analyses at the level of proteins. And when I was working on my PhD dissertation, it turned out that what our experiments indicated was that chimpanzees and humans are identical at 99% of our genes. It's true.
So what does that imply about evolution, and what does it tell us about research and you know, how chimps and humans,
why we aren't the same?
What are the scientific and evolutionary implications of the similarities?
Right. Well, in terms of the interest to people particularly concerned with recent human evolution, it means that we and chimps diverged in an evolutionary sense very recently, of course. In terms of human biology generally, what it tells us is that probably what matters in evolution are not the kinds of changes we were looking at, are not the small changes, small structural changes in genes, but are individual changes in genes that regulate when other genes are turned on and off. So that we are not chimps, not because we have radically different genes, we obviously don't, but because of the timing of the expression of those genes. And that's what's critical to development of one species as opposed to another, to divergence of species, and to development of cells in a healthy way as opposed to development of cells in an aberrant way.
So there are like master genes that regulate the other genes?
There are not master genes that regulate lots of genes at once, probably. But there are control genes, or control regions, that regulate timing of specific genes, which then in a cascade effect, of course, regulate timing of other genes and other genes and other genes.
On the show that we can see you on tonight, The Secret of Life on PBS, there's a doctor in talking about cancer who says that the way we go about trying to kill cancer cells now is through therapies that destroy cells, and we hope that they destroy more bad cells than good cells, but they kind of destroy fairly indiscriminately. He was suggesting that he thinks there are new treatments that will come along sometime in the future that will allow us to to cure cancer without killing off a lot of healthy cells too. I wonder if you see your research as being connected to that, and if your research might have any information about how to develop a new kind of cancer therapy.
I certainly hope so. I very much hope that when we identify this gene that's critical in families, and we expect in cells for the rest of us as well, that we will be able to identify cells in which this gene has gone awry, even in women that we haven't been able to diagnose early, so that for women who do have invasive disease, it will be possible to target treatment specifically to cells that carry a mutation, that specifically to cancer cells. One of my male colleagues called this a couple of years ago, smart bombs against cancer. And I think it is. What one wants to be able to do is not to kill a vast number of cells willy-nilly, but to target the treatment specifically to the ones that are malignant. This is an enormous field of research in cancer generally, and once again, I don't have nearly the skills to be able to pull this off, but I'm hoping that the information that we get about this one gene can contribute to that work in the field of cancer biology generally.
There are go ahead.
There's another whole tactic that one can attempt to apply. Gosh, I'm falling into military terminology here. Teach me, won't it? It happens to the best of us. And that is to actually try to work at the level of the gene. One thing that we're learning more and more in human genetics is that by trying to fix what has gone wrong with genes that have gone awry, not by altering people for the next generation, but by altering cells in our own bodies that aren't working properly, by fixing genes that have gone wrong, by introducing normal copies of those genes, one can sometimes reverse what has gone wrong. Of course, I don't know whether we're going to be able to do this with this gene because I don't have this gene yet, but if we could, it would be absolutely terrific. It would be a gene-specific way of curing the disease.
Let me change the subject to a completely different use of genetic research that you're involved with. I'm thinking of genetic forensic research. For instance, now you're doing some work with the U.S. military that I believe has to do with people who were missing in action. Maybe you could fill us in on what you're doing.
Sure. What the Central Identification Laboratory in Hawaii of our armed forces asked us to do recently was to help them out on some particularly difficult cases that have arisen recently from Southeast Asia, from the Vietnam War. These are cases that have, for which they have hypotheses about who the men who went missing are, but they can't be absolutely sure using classical anthropological and dental techniques of identification. So they've asked us to work with them and to identify, to sequence DNA from the teeth and sometimes from the bones, although that's much trickier, of these men, then to test those sequences against DNA sequences that we can get very easily from blood of surviving mothers, brothers, and sisters who give us samples, and to see if they match or not.
Well, that's really fascinating research, and you've also done research, as you mentioned, in Latin America. You worked in Argentina trying to match up children who had been kidnapped by the military regime, trying to match them up genetically with, I think, grandparents or parents to reunite families.
That's right. That work began at the end of the military dictatorship in Argentina. Argentina had a military dictatorship between 1975 and 1983, and when President Alfonsín was elected after the Malvinas-Falklands War in late 83, he and the human rights groups asked us if we would work with families of disappeared. What had happened during the dictatorship was that thousands and thousands of people had been kidnapped, And among those kidnapped victims were young pregnant women. When those young women were kidnapped, they were typically kept alive until they gave birth. Then they were killed, and their infants disappeared into the military subculture. And as the years went on, those children started to appear, first in kindergartens, and now, in fact, they're the age of my daughter. They're late teenagers. They're 17, 18, 19 years old, and they have put pieces together from their own history and are coming forward, realizing that they have been raised all these years, in many cases, by people who were directly involved in the murders of their parents, and they want to know who they are. And their grandmothers, that is, the people a generation older than us, the people who were the parents of the murdered adults, formed an organization first back in 1977, right at the height of the dictatorship, to collect this information. And as the years have gone on, that the information they've collected, in addition to lots of anecdotal evidence about what happened to these babies, has been DNA evidence. So we now have a DNA data bank of sequences of the maternal lineages of hundreds of infants who went missing during the military dictatorship in Argentina, so that as these children are either identified by their potential grandmothers or come forward themselves, we can tell them who they are. And of course, we can tell them who they are, and we can put them back in touch with their biological families, even if the grandmother who initiated the work has since died, because she's left her legacy in her DNA.
Right. I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your research with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Mary Claire King. She's a professor of genetics and epidemiology at the University of California at Berkeley. And you can see her this evening on many PBS stations on the series The Secret of Life, which looks at how genetic research is transforming science and medicine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.